Let's talk.
John Brown. Excellent book is called Rebel Girls. It's by Molly Tye, and I'm delighted to say that Molly joins me live on the line now. Molly, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure is indeed all mine. Just explain a little bit about yourself and why you're so eminently qualified to write Rebel Girls.
Well, I don't know about eminently qualified, but I can tell you my background is I'm a music journalist, so have been, and blogger for a little while. So my kind of music credentials, I guess, is around writing about music. So I'm not a musician myself, but write a lot about punk music specifically. I was the UK editor for an online zine called Punctuation, so I wrote a lot about punk there, and now run my own site, Punk Rock Philosophy. So that's where the, and a lifelong punk fan, so that's where the punk aspect comes in. And in my other job, my day job, I also have worked in the violence against women and girls sector for a long time as well, so working around issues relating to things like domestic abuse and stuff like that. So combining that, the two things really leads you to sort of think about feminism in punk and how women have experienced it.
And the thing I like about having sort of read the press notes about this particular book, Riot Girl, is the fact that it's not just about Susie Sue, Debbie Harry, you know, polystyrene. It is actually about the whole scene, as it were. So not only the performers, but the people who are actually watching it, the people backstage. It's taking it in a broader context, if you like, of the punk movement itself, and not just the okay, so we had this singer and that singer, and you know, and Patti Smith and Hall, you know. So there's a you're doing the whole. I mean, we call it now the holistic picture, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, I mean, that's quite an ambitious thing to do for the book, because there is a lot of punk history. We're coming up to what many people think is the 50-year anniversary of punk. So that's 50 years to kind of go through. And yeah, really what I was keen to do with Rebel Girls is, as you say, I wanted to write about the fans' perspective. So I think one of the things that people always talk about with regards to punk is how it impacted their life. You know, it's not just the music, but lots of the other things that come around it, the community, the kind of solidarity, the DIY culture, and that impacts fans, you know, really significantly. And fans are a huge part of any musical scene. They make that scene. They're buying records, they're going to gigs, supporting bands, making zines. And the other thing is that I'm a fan of so many different eras and waves of punk that I didn't want to just go focus on one sure. area. I wanted to look at how one thing on a continuum kind of led to the next. How do we get from the Ramones in New York to the Lambrini Girls in Brighton now over those 50 years? And that's really what the book's trying to do through the stories of the fans.
You see, the thing is, three chords and throw a band together, that's punk. So I've always had this theory that you like Lonnie Donegan, Buddy Holly, they're the first punks. And talking about women in music, I mean, bands like the Ronettes, for example, I got a big spot for them. Okay, it's an early evolution of girl power. And what I find really interesting, though, is the way that women in punk redefine a woman's role in music in a way that hasn't been before, because we, you know, we get the girl band, you know, we got the Motown, and they're churning out the Supremes, etc., etc., and then we got the singer songwriters, Carole King, Joni Mitchell, etc., etc. Prog rock, not a lot of time for women in prog rock at all, really. Sandy Denny notwithstanding, punk rock has got women in it, but it's really interesting because you have to, because unfortunately the music business is a tough business, and although it may be progressive music, some of the attitudes that men in the music business have to women are Neanderthal, to put it mildly.
Yeah, and later on in the book, when I'm trying to sort of bring everything together, I sort of move into thinking about the music industry as a whole and what it's like to try and, you know, infiltrate that as a female musician. And so there's definitely that aspect that it is, even in punk, still a very male-dominated scene. But women have always found very creative ways to be represented, to have their voice heard. And like you sort of alluded to, there isn't just one route for that For women, so in the chapter on 80s punk, we look at kind of American hardcore, which wasn't super representative of women in that sort of scene. But there were other incredible people like Wendy Williams. There was Alice Bag and the Bags, all very different. The Go-Go's, you know, they all sounded very different. They represented kind of different sounds, different looks, different ways of being. So it's kind of celebrating all of those options that punk isn't. You don't have to just have a mohawk and a leather jacket, and that's how you know, express punk. It really is one of the most sort of diverse and eclectic kind of subgenres of music. And with regards to the Ronettes, I'll see your Ronettes and raise you a Shangri-La.
Oh yes, one of my course. Favorite leader groups of the pack. Except they were the original bad girl group. Yeah.
I think that you know, I wrote an article years ago for Loud Women about angry songs, my favourite angry songs, and the Shangri-La's "Walking in the Sand" was one of those songs, because I think it may not sound angry in the way that a Kathleen Hanna or a Susie Sue does, but it's still full of righteous angst and yearning. And actually, that was something that I think a lot of those girl groups also did pretty well in the 60s.
Punk's not just—it's not just the music, though. Well, as well, because it's also the whole. You know, if you think about it, because you know, Sex on the King's Road, which again is seen as like one of the mother nodes of the, you know, it's Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood. Well, Vivian Westwood is a major scene on punk. You know, she dresses, she inspires. I mean, Malcolm is just basically a master marketing stroke showman. But the real power, and people will always say, oh, that terrible interview the Pistols did with, you know, Bill Grundy on the show. Susie Sue's in that interview, but she's gone. But kind of been, she's been airbrushed out of that, hasn't she? Sort of thing. So, you know, and then you think about people like, you know, Jordan, for example, who was not you know, not Katie Price. Children, yeah. the original, the best, the you know, she. There are people in the punk community who aren't performers, but are saying this is a different way. You know, we can sort of tear down the walls of bourgeois 70s. You know, Britain's in a terrible state in 77, and people go about Britain now. Trust me, should have been here first time around. And it's the way that, you know, women don't have to be in the kitchen. They don't have to be preparing Fanny Craddock's recipes, et cetera, et cetera. They can be in the arts. They can be putting safety, you know, they can be experimenting in fashion with makeup, whatever. And you can argue it's a bigger step for a girl to be a punk than it is for a bloke to be a punk.
Yeah, and there is some sort of academic sources as well that I cite sort of later on that really, really look at that, that for women in punk, the rebellion can be kind of two or even threefold. You're rebelling against kind of what societal expectations are around how women should be, how should they should look and how they should behave. The polystyrene quote, you know, people say little girls should be seen and not heard, that kind of thing. They're rebelling against the society, but also it might be that you're rebelling against those kind of patriarchal structures within punk as well. So it's kind of sort of, you know, doubly exciting and empowering for women, even within the punk scene. And you're right that women, that one of the, when I first started having the idea that I wanted to write something like this, it was going to be around those musicians and those figures throughout punk history. And then somewhere along the line of thinking about that, I thought, I feel like, A, that story's kind of been told. I'm not sure I could add anything to the story of Susie Sue or Debbie Harry or Kathleen Hanna that maybe hasn't already been stated. But actually, the scenes, the actual punk scenes are propped up and supported and nurtured by all of these other roles, people that are promoting gigs, putting on gigs, that are running record, little DIY record labels, that are creating these networks to support touring and zines, etc. And that was really what I wanted to tap into by speaking and interviewing female punk fans who do have all these weird and wonderful roles within the scene, particularly in the 70s, because it spans such a wide history that changes over the years. But in the 70s, it was very much things like running fan clubs. So if you wanted a Susie Sue badge or, you know, a signed zine, it would normally be a fan club that you would go through, sort of a mail order kind of thing. And a lot of those were run by really passionate fans.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember, because I used to get NME, Kids Ask Your Parents, and get about, you know, and, you know, I was into The Jam, and then I found out that Paul Weller's, and The Jam was run by, I think it was Paul Weller's sister, the fan club, or something like that. You know, quite.
So,
now, community, right? Because I'm fortunate enough to be a bleeding awful musician myself, but I talk to proper musicians on my show, and we talk about connection between a live audience and the stage. Because without, you know, I know it's a cliche, hey man, without the fans, we're nothing. But it really is. But with the punk movement, even more so. And I'm, you know, rock is my background, you know, the heavier side of it. And I was a goth in the 80s. You move to Spain, it's very difficult being a goth all in black when it's 90 degrees outside. But exactly. It's punk's the same, though. It's a community for those who are the misfits, the people who don't fit in, the people who don't like the latest single by Racy or by, you know, the Brotherhood of Man or ABBA, you know. And so, you know, and there's a community in the rock community. There's a community, you know, in rock fans. There's a community in punk fans that look after. You know, we may look scary, or we used to look scary, but in fact, we're the nicest people you could possibly meet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that has also kind of, it's consistent over the years, but how that looks, that community has changed. A lot of people that I spoke to, fans that I interviewed that were around in the kind of 70s and maybe early 80s, talked about that exact thing that you said, that it was around finding safety in numbers. It was around finding like-minded people that shared in a lot of your, maybe aspects of your background, your class background, your the experience that you're having under, you know, kind of Thatcher or something like that. And also being able to find solace where maybe services wouldn't be able to pick that up. So one of the people that I spoke to said that they had a lot of mental health struggles at the time, and actually there weren't the services around to support them. Where they got that support was around other people in the punk scene, because it was seen as this place where we're all misfits, so we all might as well support each other. And that is something that hasn't really changed. That's something that when I've spoken to, I think the youngest person I spoke to for the book is not about 19. And she said exactly the same thing about finding punk community now, that it's given her a space to feel like she can be herself very unapologetically and get that kind of practical and emotional support from other people. So that's always been punk's strength, I think, that it's an important part of the community.
Did you find that the UK punk experience and the US punk experience are quite two quite different things? Because, I mean, you talk about Debbie Harry. I want to talk about, because you've written about violence against women, etc. Debbie Harry, you know, has you know, she's you know, before she is a figure, you know, in New York, she's to put it mildly, pretty seriously abused. She, in fact, just narrowly escapes being murdered by Ted Bundy, for goodness sake. So there's the US experience of punk, because I mean, I suppose it's quite something to be, you know, the punk goes back, you could almost argue, to a vaudeville tradition. If you think of how Ian Dury is doing that whole the old music hall tradition, and McLaren is absolutely a ringmaster like that. The States, again, even more regimented, you could say, when it comes to sort of stereotypes of how women are supposed to behave. So if you're a Patti Smith, if you're a Debbie Harry, you can come in for even more abuse than perhaps you could do in the UK.
I'm not sure. Right. I think it really depends on one of the things that the book says is that, you know, everyone's experience has been different. So even within a particular context, like let's say the UK in the 1970s or America in the 1980s, a lot of that experience for that individual will depend on exactly where and when you are at that time, what kind of gigs you go to. The book does flip between the UK and the US quite a lot. So I do talk about the UK in the 70s, then the America in the 80s.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of similarities with kind of what they were experiencing at that time. And then the 90s, I look at Riot Girl and pop punk, and then we sort of come back to the UK for this kind of radical resurgence. And each chapter looks at the social and political context of why punk, you know, what punk was responding to at that time. And although there are a lot of really big differences, in terms of what the overall themes are. There also are a lot of similarities that ultimately a lot of punk scenes are trying to champion people that are marginalised in some way. And, you know, whether that's via their social status, their sort of racial background, their sexuality. So they all have that kind of in common. But I guess in terms of women's experience and women's safety, there were some women that I spoke to that found punk to be the only place that they felt very protected. And that was where they were felt that they were protected from things like racism and sexism. And but yet I spoke to a lot of other women who said that they felt that they didn't always feel very safe in punk. So I think it really is a mixed bag. And I think I use that phrase in the book.
Yeah.
That it's a bit of a mixed bag.
But you see, that sort of safe space in a certain way also, because a couple of years after, if we say 77 is the mother node of punk, and then we get, you know, less than 2 years later, we've got like the two-tone movement, ska, and you're seeing a lot of women who, you know, a lot of black women of colour getting involved with, you know, and doing live gigs. You know, I'm thinking the Selector, obviously Pauline Black, the Bell Stars, all that sort of, you know, those and that is something that may not have happened in, you know, in the early 70s, because it wouldn't have been such a safe space. And what I found also really interesting is this is an artist I didn't know much about at all. This is this Chilean, is it Anacha? Is it this she's War on Women? Is that the band, or
she's Band War on Women? Yeah.
Yeah, and she's from Chile, and she goes to the States, and she runs into racism there. She channels that as well, does she?
Oh no, that's one of the. So War on Women is a band, but yes. I think you're thinking of Andrea,
right? Okay,
so
yeah.
Andrea was one of the female punk fans that I interviewed. Right. So not coming at it from the point of a musician, but yeah, her story was really, really powerful, actually. Right. And obviously, for the purpose of the book, I have to edit everything down to, you know, a couple of paragraphs. But I actually spent a good few hours with Andrea when I met her in London the first time to interview her, and her experience, I think, represent something a little bit wider as well. As you say, she had gone to America with her family in the 80s from Chile, and had quite a difficult time with not experiencing racism in her neighborhood, from her you know, her teachers in her school, from you know, people in the wider community. And actually, one of the places that she felt really safe was at hardcore punk gigs. And that's really interesting, because a lot of the rhetoric around hardcore punk in the US in the 80s, so Black Flag,
yeah,
those kind of bands, they were really hectic shows. You know, they were...
Henry Rollins, for example.
There wasn't just pogoing up and down, which was kind of the experience a lot of the 70s, and that kind of gobbing, that was something that was... But in the 80s, it was slam dancing and that kind of really rough pits. And yeah, a shirtless Henry Rollins kind of getting everybody worked up on stage. So they weren't for the faint of heart being, you know, jostled about in those pits. But there's a lot of catharsis around that female punk fans experience just as much as male punk fans, that physical experience of the gig and that release. But Andrea and fans like Andrea spoke about that kind of... physicality. It wasn't targeted, or it didn't feel targeted. It was something that she was part of, and yet outside of those gigs is where she would feel much more vulnerable. And a lot of punks that I talked to spoke about that feeling as well, which is why when parents would get very, or the wider public would have that kind of panic around, oh, this punk gig is not a safe place for my child. In some cases that, you know, that may well have been borne out in individual cases, but by and large, it is meant to be a supportive environment and one that is built around solidarity and community and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, because I mean you're a little younger than I am, Molly, but you know, in the 80s, if you were a goth, it wasn't the punks you were wearing, it was the casuals, it was the, you know, it was they would have a Stanley knife and they would do, you know, untold things to you if they got hold of you. So, you know, it's not the well-dressed ones you got to watch out for, you know. It's not the quote-unquote the weirdos, i.e. me. It's the people in the Pringle bleeding sweaters. Also, what I found really interesting as well is the way that we got this, you know, we have these brilliant, you know, you mentioned Wendy Williams, you know, brilliant talent. And then and I'm going to fast forward because I've only got a couple of minutes left, but when Jagged Little Pill comes out by Alanis Morissette, it's seen as this huge new thing of female rage. Which it is, and it's out, I mean, 30 years ago now, but it's out, and it's an outstanding album, but that's tapping back into everything we've been talking about before. It's just that perhaps it hasn't been, I'm not saying commercial, because Alanis Morissette is a brilliant musician as well, but it taps into an MTV generation that hasn't been hit before, and that's why maybe Jagged Little Pill is such a big success, but there are still women who are doing hardcore or are doing that sort of rock and you know, have been doing it for years.
Yeah, and Jagged Little Pill is one of my favourite albums ever. So I do absolutely love that album. And I've written about Alanis Morissette and this kind of centering of women's rage. And yeah, I think a lot of people I think this is a good thing. A lot of generations have maybe a short memory in terms of what's gone before. So a lot of people think they've invented something or pioneered something when a lot of things are really tracked back for, you know, throughout the history of music. But I think one of the things that was good about the 90s is that it actually was quite a exciting time for women in music, depending on what you're into. I liked a lot of the girl groups, En Vogue and the TLC and stuff of the 90s. There were big divas like Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston and Celine Dion. And then there was also things like the Lilith Fair kind of singer-songwriters, Jewel and Tori Amos, Fiona Apple and Alanis Morissette. But yeah, I think that if something like Jagged Little Pill can just spark something in someone, even if they, you know, think, actually, I want more angry women music, then hopefully that will pinpoint people and signpost them to punk that's gone before, and that's a good thing.
And for those who think it's just music and punk's just this, that, and then people showing off, you've only got to see what's happening, you know, the repercussions that, you know, Pussy Riot have gone through, you know, with their, I mean, even a couple of weeks ago with, you know, the shameful decision to have Russia represented at the Biennale in Venice, and you go, and they have a demonstration there, you know, that, I mean, you can pretend that you're a dangerous bad boy rapper all you want, but at the end of the day, you're hiding behind 18,000 in your entourage. Those women put themselves on the line literally every time they kind of go out, don't they?
Yeah, and that's on a really big scale. You know, that's, and I wrote about Pussy Riot in the book and talk about how it's interesting that what punk might be fighting for will depend on its context, because Pussy Riot might talk about wanting to embed democratic, you know, processes in a country that isn't democratic, whereas you would go to maybe another more comfortable punk scene where what they want is, they don't want any of, they don't believe in those kind of democratic processes or institutions. They want more kind of liberation from those, more anarchy maybe. But actually for both of those are kind of similarly radical perspectives depending on the context that you're in. But then a lot of the women that I spoke to said that the price of being in the punk scene can be quite high, particularly maybe in the 70s and 80s when it was a bit more new and a bit more shocking and provocative.
Yeah.
That going on the riding the tube in a leather trousers or fishnets with a mohawk and you know, something provocative on your t-shirt because you got it from Vivian Westwood's boutique might mean that you're jeopardizing a lot of your personal safety. So it's a commitment and something that people find empowering, but also it can be quite scary. But that's the exciting kind of radical nature of punk.
Because at the time, you know, people go now and they go, oh, you know, they go to Carnaby Street and they'll see some people wandering around with mohawks. And it's like, we're on a holiday. We got a picture with the real punks. And like, it's like they're national treasures now. I remember, you know, back in the 70s, back in the 80s, for young women, dangerous time. And if you were dressed as a punk or, you know, a punkette or whatever, short leather skirt, the whole bit here, you know, there are certain, you know, we're talking 70s males here of middle age, you know, they did not have good, well, you know, they would be counseled, to put it mildly now, because it was downright aggression, and it would now be seen as sexual violence. Basically, they might say, "Oh, it was just a kiss, a card to get, you know, I grabbed one of those punkette girls." For blimey, but that now is assault and abuse.
Yeah, and the history of kind of how women's rights have evolved is also a big part of the book, and that is kind of where my Vogue background comes from. Yeah. Thinking about how our laws and our processes and just our understanding has changed over the years. And one of the things that I sort of conclude coming to punk up to date is that expectations have changed, quite rightly. I think what's great about young punks coming through now is that there are things that they will challenge. There are things that they are able to to see are not right, that they and that goes for fans as well, who want to know that the bands that they're supporting support them on certain positions that they have, and that includes around women's safety and recognising that, you know, there is still a way to go to making sure that women feel safe.
Now, talking about all things rock and roll, you're on tour at the moment, aren't you? I've seen you're on a book tour.
We had a really great event on Monday at Rough Trade in London to launch the book. There, so I did a Q&A with Cassie Fox from Loud Women, and there I'm in Whitley Bay, which is more my neck of the woods because I'm Newcastle based, so I'm right in Whitley Bay tomorrow, and then I'm in Rebellion Fest in August, and in Edinburgh also in August, and then some events in Sheffield and Manchester in the autumn. So yeah, punk on tour, punk book on tour.
Brilliant. I won't even ask what your rider's like. You know, I take all the green M&M and a la Maria Carey.
Oh, yeah. I won't eat green M&M.
White kittens for me to pet backstage, that sort of thing.
This is giving me ideas, I must say.
I know. I've worked in concert promotion. It's chaos theory and crisis management at all times. The book is called Rebel Girls, The Real Story of Women in Punk. Listeners, go forth to our virtual bookstore. Great front cover, by the way. Click on that and a well-known South American river-based firm will be distributing to your very front door. If people want to follow you online, I mean, you mentioned that you wrote for Punctuation. Where can they find you? Tell me you've got an online presence.
Yes, of course. Who hasn't? I have to. I'm on Instagram, Molly Ty, and I currently run my own website called punkrockphilosophy.com, right, which is lots of new releases, interviews, but it's also looking at the ethics and the values behind the punk scenes around the world. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, then check it out.
Molly, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for writing the book.
Thank you for having me.
The book is called Rebel Girls, The Real Story of Women in Punk. It's by Molly Ty. Molly, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.